From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. In a tweet this morning, President Trump compared House Democrats' impeachment inquiry to a lynching. On Fox News, White House spokesman Hogan Gidley defended the president.
The president wasn't trying to compare himself to the horrific history in this country at all. What he was trying to point out clearly was that he has been attacked relentlessly by the mainstream media without cause, without evidence, since the day he took over in this office.
Trump's language, his use of this language, which is associated with the history of lynching of Black Americans, comes as the top American diplomat in Ukraine testifies behind closed doors about what he knows regarding allegations that Trump requested Ukraine investigate Democrats for him. Joining us is Susan Davis, NPR congressional correspondent. And Sue, first of all, this tweet comparing the inquiry to lynching, Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy spoke this morning, and he distanced himself from the language and then went on to blame Democrats on the handling of the inquiry.
That's not the language I would use. It's very clear that what the Democrats are doing here does not go across, does not have due process. It's not fair in the process. It's not something that this House has done ever in the past.
Susan, what's been the reaction specifically to this tweet?
Well, among Republicans, I think you've heard a lot like McCarthy there saying they didn't approve of the language, but that they believe that the president has a point. Other allies of the president, senators like Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, have gone even further to defend the use of the word lynching itself, saying this is a lynching in every sense. That's what Graham told reporters. This is un-American, was what he added. You know, I think it speaks to how partisan the moment is, because you have a very different reaction across the other side of the aisle. You have many members of the Congressional Black Caucus condemning that language, saying it is painful and hurtful language, and some even raising the question of whether the House should vote to condemn the president's words.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, let's talk about the testimony now. Acting Ambassador to Ukraine William Taylor is testifying today, as I mentioned. He's the diplomat who tweeted to another diplomat, quote, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign." That was something of a bombshell because the president denied there was a quid pro quo on aid to Ukraine. What are you expecting Taylor to say under oath today?
Right. And that text message was in an exchange with Gordon Sondland, one of the president's appointed ambassadors who testified on Capitol Hill behind closed doors last week. We aren't getting much out of this testimony because it is happening behind closed doors. It's happening in private where they're being questioned mainly by staffers, although members are witnessing much of the proceedings. We have talked to a couple of members who have been in the room and have come out today. They have been sort of advised not to tell us too many of the details. But one Democrat, Ami Bera, a Democrat from California, said that Taylor has been, in his words, pretty candid, that he's being very forthcoming in his testimony and telling everything he knows. Another Democrat, Andy Levin, he's a freshman lawmaker from Michigan, came out and told reporters he classified his testimony as something that has contributed to his word, his most disturbing day in Congress so far. So it sounds like it is a fairly compelling testimony from a key fact witness in the impeachment inquiry.
Okay. There's so many names and actions to keep track of.
It's hard to follow.
Also,
I know.
I know.
It's very hard to follow. It's hard to follow for all of us doing it day by day. So I know it's very hard for people on the outside to keep track as well.
Yeah, but trying to get it straight for listeners, there are news reports today that diplomat George Kent told lawmakers last week that Trump's thinking on Ukraine was influenced by conservative Hungarian president Viktor Orban, who is an ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin. What more can you tell us about that?
Now, there have been media reports in The New York Times and The Washington Post that in just days before a key meeting in Ukraine, President Trump had a meeting at the White House with Orban. And this meeting happened at the objection of people like John Bolton, his former national security advisor, and another former top NSC official, Fiona Hill, another woman who has testified to the impeachment inquiry, saying that it was a bad idea because Orban held many negative views about the Ukraine that were not in line with U.S. policy. Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney greenlit that meeting. He was fine with it. What we know of that meeting is that Orban did share with the president many negative views about Ukraine, about their government there, and leading many people to believe that it sort of validated the president's suspicion and concern about the Ukraine government and wanting them to press them to do these types of investigations.
Massachusetts Democrat Stephen Lynch says that we are getting closer when we talk about how the Democrats might call for a vote on impeachment. What's next in terms of evidence gathering?
You know, they have the Chairman Engel said today there's a few more witnesses they want to hear from. The thing I hear mainly from Democrats is that they would still like to wrap up this work by the end of the year, although no one is willing to put a hard timeline on it. As House Speaker Pelosi said, the truth will be the timeline.
Yeah, that's the question we're all asking. Thank you so much, Susan Davis, NPR congressional correspondent.
You're welcome.
Well, we are watching a number of developments in Syria today amid the U.S. troop pullout. A U.S. brokered ceasefire between Turkey and the Kurds ends today. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi is just back from the region and joins us now. Hi, Ali.
Hello there.
And let's start with the ceasefire, which some have pointed out wasn't a total ceasefire.
Right.
What happens when it ends today?
So a ceasefire would typically mean there are negotiations about what happens next. This was literally a pause in the fighting so that the Kurds could get out of the way. And they're not entirely happy with this. It was a 120-hour break. It ends at 3 p.m. Eastern today. President Erdogan of Turkey has been meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Remember, this is beneficial to the Russians and the Iranians, who both prop up the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. Erdogan warned Kurdish forces that the military offensive is going to re-begin. So anybody who's in the safe zone that Turkey has declared is going to be attacked. I cannot imagine that the pause is going to end and fighting's not going to resume at this point.
Well, and give us a greater sense of Russia's interest here. They, as you say, are connected to the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. But why is Russia so interested in Syria in the first place?
Well, first of all, because it gives them a port on the Mediterranean. It gives them a military presence in the region, which is significant, and it gives them access to the Mediterranean Ocean from a military and a commercial perspective. So Russia has long had an interest in the area. So has Iran. They have been propping up the Syrian regime. Without Russia and Iran, the Syrian regime probably couldn't have survived the last several of years. President Putin is calling the situation severe in the country, but nobody's got an answer to how this is going to work. And the Kurds were a U.S. allied group that was fighting ISIS. Remember, from a Turkish perspective, ISIS was never the problem in Syria. They don't like the Kurds having a foothold because these Kurds in Syria are related to Kurds in Iraq, in Iran, in Armenia, and in Turkey, and they've been calling for an independent state in Turkey. So while the rest of the world was worrying about ISIS and, to some degree, the Syrian regime, the Turks, who are NATO allies, were always more interested in the Kurds.
Meanwhile, back in Washington today, James Jeffrey, who is the U.S. Special Representative for Syria, is going to be questioned by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. What can we expect to see there?
Well, some tough questioning, probably by the people in Congress, the Republicans in Congress, who don't share President Trump's view on pulling U.S. troops out and allowing the Turks to go into this area. So Mitt Romney and Lindsey Graham will be very critical. James Jeffrey, the special representative, said that there's no way Turkey is going to support an ongoing situation where the U.S. supports the Kurds in Syria. But on the other hand, the Senate panel includes Rand Paul, who's been very supportive of the president's move to withdraw troops because there are a lot of Republicans who say the U.S. is involved in too many wars that they don't need to be in. So I think it'll be an interesting conversation in the Senate.
You mentioned that Turkey is a member of NATO. Obviously, there has been criticism from within the United States about the invasion by Turkey of that part of Syria, but also from other NATO countries. What does it mean to have this division within NATO?
It's a very, very big deal because Turkey is the only Muslim nation in NATO. Incirlik Air Force Base is used as the forward operating base in many cases for activity in the Middle East. Remember, we've got a base there, and the U.S. has a base in Qatar as well, and the U.S. has tensions with Qatar as well. So we've got, you know, tens of thousands of troops in the neighborhood. And it's just a challenge to NATO. NATO has been under threat really since Donald Trump took office. Donald Trump has never really believed in the strength of the alliance. So it's a big problem, which is why you're not even seeing particularly strong responses from NATO countries or the NATO Secretary General. They're saying things like there are serious concerns and they hope this doesn't happen and they're going to take measures to stop. But everybody's been very, very cautious about how to deal with Turkey because Turkey isn't an adversary. It's not an enemy. It's actually an ally. ally that's now doing something that is working against another ally of the United States.
Ali, as we mentioned at the top, you are just back from Jerusalem, where Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Israel also quite concerned about all of this.
Yeah, although probably Israel has less reason to be, because the U.S. support for Israel, whether there's been a president like Donald Trump, who is so very fully supportive of everything Israel does, or a president like Barack Obama or George Bush, who are more critical of them, it hasn't really wavered. So the idea, it does scare a lot of people that, wow, 11,000 Kurds died side by side with Americans in Syria fighting fighting the Syrians, fighting ISIS. Israel's in a different situation. It gets heavy funding from the United States, and Donald Trump's pro-Israel policies are only stronger than congressional policies already are. And remember, Benjamin Netanyahu may have a problem keeping his seat as the prime minister.
And we're getting into that elsewhere in the program today. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks as always.
Thanks, John.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
One of the hottest tickets on Broadway right now makes the audience part of the act. It's called Freestyle Love Supreme, and it's the brainchild of the creative minds behind In the Heights and Hamilton. And joining me now are three of the cast members, Utkarsh Ambudkar, who goes by UTK the INC. Welcome.
Thank you, sir.
And Chris Sullivan, who goes by Shockwave.
Yes,
good to talk
yes.
to you.
That's me.
And Anthony Veniziale, or Two Touch, welcome to you as well.
Cheers. Good to be here, Jeremy.
Okay, so Anthony, I want to start with you because you are credited with creating this show along with Lin-Manuel Miranda and Thomas Kail. How did this all get started?
It was just a terrible idea that spun into an awful 15 years. We were working on In the Heights at the Drama Bookshop, and we had all gone to Wesleyan together. Lin was there sort of workshopping and working under Tommy's guidance, and I was sort of the interlocutor who would jump in and be like, Lin, let's freestyle rap. And I just convinced Lin that it was a good idea to do this in front of people, because like we did it at every cast party. We did it in between breaks and stuff. And then finally I convinced him, and we had a show on August 16th of 2003, which is the day after the Eastern Seaboard blackout on August 15th of 2003.
Uh-huh, right. Yes, a very famous moment in New York City history. Was it always, though, in those early days, successful enough that you thought this is a good idea? Because I can imagine it going wrong if you're just not all in sync with each other about how to make words people say into something that's compelling and entertaining.
I think the short answer is yes. The long answer is no, yes, sometimes. I mean, when you do this thing, especially when you're first starting out, like, it's terrifying and you're terrible at it. And I'm still terrible at it. There are some shows that I have where I'll try to set up a rhyme and I fail at it. But that's, I think, a part of our show. We allow the audience to see the rough edges and some of the mistakes. And so more importantly for me was that the audience was with us. And when we made those mistakes, it kind of even got us more empathy and more cred with the audience that it was happening in the moment. So once that happened, it's one of those things you're like, oh, I need to do this all the time. It's my favorite thing. Oh, God, I can't wait to do it again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think we've gone on too long without giving listeners an idea of what we're talking about here.
Sure.
So what you do in the show involves audience members giving you words and you all freestyle off of those words. I guess since I'm the audience now, you tell me what you want and you can do what you do.
Great. Why don't you give us like a word at a time and we'll just ask you for the next word and we'll have UTK kick it off and Shock will do a beat and then he'll maybe trade with me at some point and I'll give it a shot to fail miserably as well.
Okay, and I'm going to look at our show and the words that are in our show in the news right now. So Brexit.
Okay, here we go. Jeremy, let me step in. Exit, like the UK did with Brexit. I'll break it apart, put it together. That's right, I spit these flows forever. Give me another word.
Israel.
Baruch atah Adonai. When I spit so fly, I do it till I'm full. I do it for Israel. Do it for Jerusalem without a pen. And I spit a Broadway show with all of my friends. One more word.
Election.
Okay, do it for your protection. No politics, don't want to talk elections. Just want to say you should get out and vote. Whatever you do is fine for me. And I just hope you express your voice. Take a choice, because it's yours, your power. That's right, don't be a coward. Put on your cowl, put on your cape. Because if you vote when you can, it would be great. Now I'm going to pass it off to Anthony. And you could give him a word, and he can show you what he does.
Oh my God, that was so good.
Apples.
Okay, well, thanks for giving me that much lower stage of entry. You see, I'm just like Scrapple in the Midwest of Pennsylvania. No apples to be in my brain. I'm not no Johnny Gold. I'm just feeling like I was a cameo. Or maybe you could Macintosh on my flow.
Oh. In other words?
Whistleblower.
All right. Could we even get any lower? I mean, this country needs more whistleblowers. I'm not looking at the White House. I'm just looking for how I can get out.
So, yeah.
That's kind of what we do.
Wow.
Yeah, we do that. Yeah. I'm going to be honest, Jeremy, your giving of the words.
Bad
next
words.
Time, we should just go a little faster. That's for you. Next rehearsal, we're going to work on that.
I'm just a lowly audience member. I don't know how this is.
No, the audience member makes up most of our show, so you're an exalted audience member.
Well, and I have to say, when I went, one of the words was empathy. Ah. And then it becomes a whole song that involves the word empathy. And I thought to myself, and of course I'm sitting there like trying to figure out how the magic trick works. And I'm like, I wonder if it has to be a 3-syllable word. Is there anything about the number of syllables that goes into what you do?
That's a great question, a very technical question from an intelligent and exalted audience member who needs to work on his word giving, but otherwise is crushing. No, we don't hold a syllable structure or anything. Certainly the more syllables, it can be fun. We all know that there are certain rhymes, ATE words, invigorate, instigate, imitate, that have more rhymes that go with them. But the point is to pick a word and then speak the truth.
You're also pulling together pieces of everything that the audience has said to you throughout the show that you might not even use directly, but you'll remember it and bring it back later, which brings an even bigger reaction from the audience when you do that. You got to have your memory working all cylinders running throughout that entire show.
Yeah, basically like our job and the way that we support it and what makes the show such a fun event for the audience and for us is that it's a real exercise in hyper-listening. When Anthony or Shockwave or Lynn or whoever's on stage, it's my sort of privilege and gift to be able to listen to them and give them all of my energy. And we've sort of just learned to retain the things that the audience likes along the way so that we can give them the joy of bringing it back up.
Now, one of the things that you do at this show, which I've never seen before, although, frankly, in this modern age where everybody's using their cell phones all the time, it seems like it's a pretty good idea that we should do this, which is that you take every – not you, but the people that, as you walk into the theater, they take everybody's phone and put it in a little pouch that immediately locks and can't be unlocked until the show is over. What's that about?
Well, there's also an escape clause, which is if you have an emergency and you need to get it open, you can leave the theater at any time. And it's just this little magnetic thing that opens it, just like if you were shopping at the Gap and you left with that little tag on. But the reason why we did that for our show was a couple of big points for us. First, it helps the audience to be really connected as a community. And what we're doing up there on stage, yes, we deeply listen to you, the audience. And then what we're asking from you is that you deeply listen to us. The hope here is that we're all in the moment together witnessing these connections and the neural networking that's taking place in our brains that's then creating a mesh network out there in the audience as well. So that's one. Two, we're also saying crazy things. We are doing stuff as characters of the audience and made up worlds. And if someone were to film that and then take it out of context, I mean, any night you could probably get a recording of me pretending to be Trump saying, I want the world to end and this is our society now, I'm going to rule forever. And like if you take that out of context, yeah, I mean, the alt-right would really love to smear me with that, I'm sure. So what we're saying to the audience is, hey, we're going to be vulnerable as well. So we don't want that then leaving this community afterward in a way that would potentially damage anyone.
I wonder if other Broadway shows are going to pick up this idea, because it is annoying when somebody pulls their phone out in the middle of a show.
Yeah, that glowing white light. Exactly. Yeah, it's funny for those of us who remember before cell phones.
What?
It's almost a no-brainer. We're on stage and it just feels – it harkens back to more innocent times.
The late 90s.
Thank you, Morgan Freeman.
Chris Sullivan, let me ask you, because you run the Freestyle Love Supreme Academy, which is a school for people who want to learn how to do what you do. Is it very difficult to teach it?
No, absolutely not. It's not difficult to be in it either. Myself and Anthony and Andrew Bancroft, a.k.a. Jelly Donut, also a member of Freestyle Love Supreme, we sort of a combination of responding to the demand of people asking, how do we do this? And aside from saying 15 years of practice, there are also other building bones to learning this process.
Anissa Folds, who is a member of Freestyle Love Supreme, she goes by Young Niece, went through the Freestyle Love Supreme Academy with these guys and is now with us every single night on Broadway, which is to say that if you take the Freestyle Love Supreme Academy class, you'll end up on Broadway. It's a guarantee. It's in the bylaws. If you do the class, you go on Broadway. Am I right, guys?
We can edit this, right?
Okay, before we let you guys go, I want to just have you do something which we'll probably save forever, which is, can you do a Here and Now freestyle?
Are we here? Are we now? Yeah, we came to put it down with the sound. Are we here? Are we now?
Yeah, we came together, put it down, down with the sound. Are we here, here, here? Are we now, now, now?
Yeah, we came to put it down with the sound. Yeah, are we here, are we now? I'm gonna speak quiet, then loud. That's right, I'm proud of the team we have made. That's right, I like the sound and it plays on the radio like every day. Here we are, spitting it on NPR.
Yeah, NPR, can you just be like Albert Camus and maybe get a little existential? Cause are you here or are you now? I don't know, what is it detrimental? Come on, UTK, it's elemental.
Oh yeah, existential. Damn, I'm here and now like Van Damme. And time cop, that's right, I stopped. I may have dropped the bar just a little bit.
Is it here? Is it now? How are we gonna put it down with the sound? Is it here?
Is it
now?
Is it now?
How are we gonna put it down with the sound?
With the sound.
Amazing, guys. Thank you so much. That is Anthony Veneziale, Chris Sullivan, and Utkarsh Ambudkar. Thank you so much to all of you, and good luck with Freestyle Love Supreme on Broadway.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Jeremy. And remember, take the class. You'll end up on Broadway.
No, wait, I'll be there.
Not the message.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
A new variety of apple is coming to stores in December, and it's expected to be a game changer. It's called Cosmic Crisp because of the bright yellowish dots on its skin, which look like distant stars, and apparently it stores well. This is good news for the apple industry because in some eastern states, there is a new threat to apples. Researchers call it rapid apple decline, and they're trying to figure out what's causing it. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
Noah Petronic is worried about his apple trees. He's orchard manager at Sorgel Orchards, just off the highway in southwestern Pennsylvania. We start walking down a row of Braeburns. Most of the trees look healthy, with green leaves and bountiful red fruit. But a couple have taken on a strange rusty hue and are clearly struggling.
You can just see the first two trees you hit right here have shut down just over the past few weeks. We can walk through it here, and I can point out about another five or six that are shutting down.
Petronic says he started noticing this around 2013.
You have beautiful crop on, you know, especially August, September, your apples are starting putting on color, size, especially your later varieties like Fuji and Braeburn and Johnnigold. And then all of a sudden, you come back a week later, and it would be dead.
Apple trees are actually made up of two parts that are grafted together. Growers choose a type of rootstock and then graft the apple varieties, the Braeburn or the Golden Delicious, onto it. Petronik scrapes his boot along the bark of a dying tree just above the root.
You can see where the graft union is down there. That's just totally necrotic. It's rotting away.
That rot at the graft is the telltale sign of rapid apple decline.
This year, it's been horrible.
Carrie Peters is a tree fruit pathologist at Penn State. She told me by Skype that she's heard from some 50 apple growers this year.
I've been so overwhelmed in 2019 by reports of massive tree die-off that it's been difficult to keep up with it.
Pennsylvania is the nation's fourth largest apple producer. Rapid apple decline is also hitting New York, North Carolina, and Ontario. Peters and other researchers looked at common apple problems like soil pathogens, viruses, and even rodents.
And everything came back negative. But the common thread with these declining or dead trees is that the collapse is at the graft union. The roots were perfectly healthy, and the graft union was dying.
Researchers say it's not an insect or a disease that spreads from tree to tree. A recent study by Cornell University found that weather-related stress like drought and severe colds could be an underlying cause. But Peters has other theories, including increased rainfall or certain herbicides. She says a variety of stressors could be working together to lead to rapid apple decline.
Because we just don't know.
Back at Sorgel Orchards, Noah Petronik shows me a new variety he just planted, Crimson Crisp, and then bites on a stamen wine sap from a 40-year-old tree.
It's just baffling. It's heartbreaking, really, because you're taking care of these trees, you know, for years and years, and all the care that you can give the tree, you know, and all of a sudden it just, you know, doesn't make it.
Petronik says to continue growing local produce for customers, orchards like his will have to keep working with researchers and trying new rootstocks in hopes that they can adapt to rapid apple decline. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Brandt.
Now that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has thrown in the towel on forming a new coalition government, his rival Benny Gantz will get a chance. Gantz's centrist party won one seat more than Netanyahu's in last month's election, the second election this year, and if Gantz can't form a government, there could be a third election. Neri Zilber is a journalist and senior fellow at the British think tank BICOM. He's in Tel Aviv. Hi, Neri.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first of all, Netanyahu had 28 days to form a government. He gave up a couple days ahead of that deadline. Why did he fail?
He failed for the simple reason that he didn't have the seats to form a governing coalition. He's made overtures to Benny Gantz and other parties as if he's willing to make some compromises to form that coalition. But in reality, nobody was willing to budge, including Netanyahu. So now Gantz has his crack at forming a government.
And does this mean that Netanyahu's time as Israel's prime minister is over?
I wouldn't go that far just yet. It definitely is a reversal for Netanyahu, but we kind of knew this coming out of last month's election. The numbers weren't great. At the very least, he's lost control over events. But really, both sides are kind of retrenching into their previous positions. Nobody's willing to budge, neither Netanyahu and his Likud party, neither Benny Gantz and his Blue and White party, and the various other parties that they need to actually form a government here.
But isn't Gantz's first move now going to be to go to either Netanyahu or people in his Likud party for help in forming his own coalition government?
Right. So this is where things get a bit complicated. Benny Gantz isn't willing to sit with Netanyahu, or at least give Netanyahu the first chance at serving as prime minister in some kind of rotation or arrangement. Likud aren't willing to jettison Netanyahu in order to facilitate some kind of grand coalition with Benny Gantz's party. Various other parties aren't willing to sit with the ultra-Orthodox parties. Most parties aren't willing to sit with the Arab-Israeli parties. So it's fairly complicated beyond Benny Gantz and Benjamin Netanyahu. But really, something has to give.
As we said, if Gantz is unable to form a government, then there will be a third election, something that Israelis don't really want to do. Is that your sense of what's going to happen, that there'll be a third election?
It's a growing possibility. Benny Gantz has a month to try to figure things out. There is the option of another extension and perhaps another person trying to form a government well into December. And only then might we go to another and third election, as you mentioned, in the past year. It's interesting that over here, both sides are blaming the other already for precipitating a third election. So really, there's a kind of blame game going on that almost supersedes the actual coalition negotiations.
Meanwhile, Neri, in neighboring Syria, as we've been talking about, there is a major conflict going on, a ceasefire that ends today. How does Israel feel about what's happening there?
Well, it's being very closely watched, what's happening in northern Syria. Netanyahu and most other Israeli politicians have come out very, very publicly and very strongly in support of the Kurds. But more pertinently, Donald Trump, his sudden withdrawal from Syria is being viewed here in a very negative light. It's almost a reflection from in many people's minds here of the unreliability of Trump and the Trump administration. And they say, you know, not that the same thing that they happened to the Kurds will happen to Israel, but that, you know, what is Trump's word actually worth and what is his grand design in the Middle East if he's stating repeatedly that he wants to leave the region?
That's very interesting because, of course, Trump is very popular in Israel compared to his popularity in almost any other country on earth.
That's right. And Trump was riding high and Netanyahu was actually using his close relationship with Trump for political gain, kind of leveraging that domestically here. But again, in recent weeks, especially given the American withdrawal from Syria, but not only the fact that the U.S. hasn't really responded to various Iranian provocations in the Persian Gulf, the fact that Trump is willing to, at least in theory, sit down with Iran and renegotiate a nuclear deal, all of that taken together in recent months has actually undermined Netanyahu's overall foreign policy. And it's also undermined Netanyahu's political capital domestically because Trump isn't as popular, shall we say, as he was even just a few months ago.
That's Neri Zilber, a journalist and senior fellow at the British think tank BICOM, joining us from Tel Aviv. Thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, here in this country, UPS said this week that it will expand the use of drones to deliver medical supplies on hospital campuses and that it's looking into using drones for home delivery of prescriptions from CVS. Drones are already being used by police and fire officials, the military, farmers, filmmakers. But I'm curious why, when there's a breaking news story, I still hear this. Local TV news helicopters, sometimes a number of them, in the same place at the same time. Well, one station that dumped its chopper in favor of a drone is KETV in Omaha, Nebraska, where Josh Geer is a producer and photographer. Josh, why did your station get rid of the helicopter?
So back, it would have been in the early 1980s, you know, there was the sort of proverbial chopper wars where if you were in local news, you needed a helicopter. In a market like Omaha, though, the sustainability of that wasn't really going to last. There was a lot of cost to it. There's a lot of manpower and resources to make something like that work. It just wasn't feasible for a long-term kind of solution for us.
So now you're using drones. When did you start using drones and why?
So we first got our drone actually just about a year ago. We were part of a big move within our company to get a bunch of this new technology into the stations. We were one of the early ones to get involved in this, and it has worked out really nicely. You know, it gives markets in our company, we have a bunch of big markets that could still use helicopters where that's a very feasible, reasonable idea. But for us, we can now get the type of photography and news coverage that those entail without needing the rather intensive resource of a traditional news helicopter.
What kind of footage do you get from the drones?
So we've been able to get a lot of different things. We've used it for oftentimes like a traffic coverage sort of thing. If there's an accident or if there's some serious sort of bottlenecking or slowing down on highways and interstates to alert drivers about those sorts of things. This past year, we've had a tremendous amount of flooding throughout the Midwest that we've used to really deploy and show the extent of the damage. You know, it's very easy to say, well, this field is flooded, but to get up in the air and really show this is acres and acres, miles and miles of flooding, it really lends that different element that we weren't able to get very easily prior to that.
So let's talk about the comparisons with a helicopter. Is there anything that you feel that you can't do that you wish you could do with the drone that you would have been able to do with the helicopter?
You know, there are issues of things like people have gotten used to seeing helicopters up in the air. You know, when they know there's a big news event going on, they are very understanding of, oh, there you go, there's, you know, this station and that station up in the air covering it. They aren't quite used to seeing drones in the air around events like that. So really, it's the ease of the helicopter for a lot of folks is not having to explain what the helicopter's doing. They just know.
How does the cost compare? How much does a drone cost, or how much does it cost to operate it?
We have a rather nice drone, the Inspire 2 from DJI, with different lenses, assortment of batteries, things like that. It was an investment all told of about $10,000. It's not cheap. However, a traditional news helicopter, usually leased hundreds of thousands of dollars for the overall life of the lease agreement. In addition, you have to outfit it with news equipment. That's another $10,000 to $15,000. You're paying the manpower to fly it. So we're able to get a good product for what we need for substantially less, but with the same type of training and awareness that a lot of your traditional helicopter pilots and folks like that would have.
Do you think that, let's say 5 years from now, most stations are going to be using drones rather than helicopters to get aerial footage?
That is a good possibility. I would not be surprised. I think that as the costs continue to go down, as the quality continues to improve, I think a lot of stations and a lot of companies are going to look and say, we can get about as good a product for a substantially better value. I think that may be the decision a lot of folks make.
Well, I have to say that I was at a gathering recently that was, newsworthy. It was a big event, and a helicopter came and hovered overhead, and it was so annoying. I thought, I wish they were just using a drone instead so they didn't have to become the story.
And that's a very big, important part for us as well. You know, the drones are not as loud. They do make a presence. They are a herd. So it is something that we are aware of very, very well on the ground.
That's Josh Geer, who's a producer and photographer for KETV in Omaha, Nebraska, which doesn't have a helicopter anymore and now uses a drone to get aerial footage. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you.
And here's some irony. There was a climate protest going on recently, and above it, three gas-guzzling helicopters buzzing around to get their live shots.
There's been lots of scrutiny in recent years over the ways our nation's public schools select students to be a part of gifted and talented programs. Children, some as young as 4 years old, can take entrance exams which afford them an accelerated education on through high school. And there are well-documented reports of wealthy parents spending thousands of dollars for outside tutors and complaints that schools don't often tell parents of color about these programs and that they're even an option. In Seattle, for instance, less than 2% of the students in the accelerated program are Black. It's what prompted 18-year-old Azure Savage to write a book called You Failed Us, Students of Color Talk Seattle Schools. Welcome, Azure.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you're now a senior at Garfield High School in Seattle, where Black and Hispanic students make up about 34% of the population. But yet in AP classes, advanced placement classes, it's pretty segregated. And you point out the reasons for this go all the way back to sometimes kindergarten when students can test into these accelerated programs. Tell us a bit more about how this works.
Yeah, so when you are in kindergarten, most students are offered to take a test for this program. When I was placed into it, it was called the Accelerated Progress Program. It's changed names a couple times now, but it's always been the same program. And from then on, you are in the same program, and that will track you all the way through elementary school, middle school, and then will continue to influence your high school experience. And when I placed into it, I was the only Black student in my class for almost every single year. And when you get to high school, it's definitely causes a big impact on what classes you will choose to take then, because even though they say it's up to the student, your past experience of what classes you've been in, what classes your friends are going to be in, and what you think you'll be capable of has a huge impact on whether or not you will choose to take a honors class, an AP class, versus a regular class.
And there's this distinction. For most of the years, you were the only Black student in your classroom. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't that way for the school. There was this segregated system in the school. And tell me a little bit about that.
At Thurgood Marshall, there were already students there who were not in the HCC capable cohort. They were all brown and black students. So there were a lot of black and brown students at my school. They were there. They probably made up probably the majority of the population at my school. However, I didn't know any of them. I didn't have classes with any of them. So it was completely segregated in terms of what program you were in. And it was obviously a racial thing.
What was that like for you to know that you're black, but then to see across the hall other students who were just like you, but they weren't a part of this highly selected, highly capable program?
It gave me a lot of issues with my identity because I was very aware of race from a very young age. I wasn't confused about what made me different. I was super aware that it was because of my skin color. It was because I was a different race than these people. But I wasn't sure if, since I was in this white program, I was even really allowed to claim the idea that I was black. I wasn't sure if I was, per se, allowed to be black. I wasn't sure if that was an identity that I was even allowed to take on because I felt like I didn't know much about it. I didn't have any friends who were black. It made me very confused as a child about who I was and where I fit in.
The name of your book is You Failed Us. I know that many of the students are angry. I just read that Garfield High School, there was an op-ed written by another student of color talking about this program and the ways that students were segregated. Mm-hmm. What do you want people to take away from it?
I think that, above all, this program needs to be dismantled completely. Underlying all of this is a lot of institutional racism, and I don't see how this program, in the way it's set up, could ever possibly be fully equitable and have absolutely no racism involved.
Azor, you say that you want this program to be dismantled, but the other side of the argument is, well, it also affords you a better education. Why wouldn't you want to see this maybe opened up to all students? Is there a way to make it open for all students instead of abolishing a program like this?
Well, I think if it's open to all students, then I don't understand how that would be the same program. Because if this is just like for everyone, then it's not a program.
Special.
It's just, yeah, it's not special. It's just how the district will work. And that's exactly what I think should happen. I think that, for one, taking a test when you're young, like before you even hit puberty, is not going to determine at all where you're going to end up.
This is happening in Seattle, but there are programs in school districts like this throughout the nation. What changes do you want to see in the education system?
It needs to be acknowledged to the fullest extent that the system right now is racist. It's not working for students of color. Schools need to be more open to hearing from their students. A lot of times student voices are silenced within this system. But I think it has given me a lot of hope and a feeling of power because I'm seeing not only me, but so many other students at the same time, students of color from different schools in the area, all wanting to come together and make some real change in this school district.
Azor Savage has written a book about this experience called You Failed Us, Students of Color Talk Seattle Schools. Thank you so much, Azor, for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
I'm Tanya Mosley. A popular gaming company suspends a champion gamer after he calls for the liberation of Hong Kong.
Perhaps someone, one of their Chinese business partners, had said, "Hey, you know, this is pretty big deal here. You need to come down pretty hard on that."
They claim their action has nothing to do with politics. That's next time on Here and Now.